Good evening. At this time, we begin the TechNet. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. Along with K2 KEY, Mel, we attempt to try to answer people's questions about ham radio. With a little help of our friends. Ham radio is a pretty complicated hobby. So guaranteed you want to know something about your transmission lines, your antennas, your favorite transmitters, your favorite receivers, modes of propagation, the 26 different kinds of ham radio, how does radio propagation really work, lots and lots of stuff to learn. It's only taken Mel and I two-thirds of a lifetime to learn what we know, and we still are amazed to find we're learning something every day. Wireless is pretty wild stuff. You don't believe it? Just listen to a few of the past TechNets. Listen to some of the crazy questions. The subject matter covered by the TechNet almost every single week consists of the questions and subject matter you guys bring to the TechNet. You are you're the authors of this stuff. With rare exception, we don't set the agenda. You guys do. So, and most of us have come to the conclusion now there's no such thing as a dumb question, so don't worry about that. Some of the very simple questions have really got some pretty deep and subtle answers when you get down to what in the world Mother Nature is really telling us or trying to tell us. A person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and Dick your call letters first, your name second, try not to forget the name, because I always do, and then the third piece of information is a yes or a no, usually a yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this, N2EO, Rich and Yes, one of our frequent sign-ins. Do we have any check-ins? Well, give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW listening.
K2MB, without question.
Yes.
Okay, I heard Barry in 2MB and another person who said yes, who doubled with them. Who was that person? Was the other person Mel? I know I got Barry. And there was at least two people who checked in on top of each other. Barry and who else was the other person?
Okay, I'll say good evening to all. This is KEY. Maybe I'll start some people up.
Fine. Very fine, Mel. There was another person who said the word yes, but we got nothing else because it got covered up. Who was that? Okay. Say again. Please say that one more time, sir.
If I can get into the repeater, yes.
Okay, if I can get into the repeater, yes. Who are you, sir? Okay, on the input, I heard you say Romeo, Papa, Echo. Want to give me the rest of your call? Okay, there's somebody out there called Romeo, Papa, Echo, who I think checked in. Okay, we've got Barry. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
This is WS2N. Good evening, Dick, Paul, and no questions, but we'll do a space science report.
Very fine, Paul. Looking forward to hearing from you. One last call. Anyone else to check into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now.
KC2OES, Fred, Petersburg.
Okay, KC2OES, Fred, and I think that's with a yes. Anyone else?
K2KYQ, Joe, and we're just listening in tonight. Very interesting segment.
Okay, K2KYQ, Joe, with a no, and there was a double. Who was the other person who was checking in just now?
N2GWX, Vic, with no traffic.
Okay, Vic with a no, GWX. Hey, Barry, looks like we got a pretty light night so far. You got lots of time, and And the Mr. Forrest I know usually has quite a few questions, so fire away. N2 Moon Dove, K2RAW on the TechNet.
Wait a minute, you never gave me a chance to sign it, Dick.
Okay. Very good, Ed. We've got Ed. And Ed, are we going to have any questions from you tonight?
No, I'm just trying to prove that despite your protest, there really is such a thing as a stupid question. Go ahead, Barry.
Okay. Barry, you got it.
Okay, W-8-2-Y-Y, Joe, checking in.
I don't have a good question, but I'll have some later. How do you make money on the internet? No, just kidding. Echolink on Limark. I understand there's an input to Limark on Echolink. In fact, I think you may have been hearing one tonight, having trouble getting in. But does anybody know how to do that? And QMB?
It's not quite, well, there's both Echolink and there's VOIP. There's a VOIP linking between the Eastern repeater, 147.375, and this repeater. For instance, Joe, W-8-2-RYY, just checked in, and quite possibly he checked in by way of the 147.375 machine. We have to all make sure we leave enough delay in between so that the all the proper dropouts and resetting of the VOIP takes place. And from time to time, there are linkings to other repeaters in the New England area. Now, I think there's a fancy number you have to dial in order to link your particular repeater to another repeater by way of the echo link process. That's about as much as I know. I'm hoping somebody within earshot has a hell of a lot more smarts about it than I do. If so, please give us your call letters right now. K2RIW.
W-8-2-Y-Y.
Okay, Rich and Joe recognized in that order. Rich, you could use a lot more audio, and please, Mr. President, tell us how to use Echolink and VOIP and all these other fancy things that are on your repeater. Rich, you got it.
All right, Dick and everyone on the net. The TechNet is linked, or the repeater is actually linked to the New England reflector, but the reflector is like a large conference call that is available worldwide. To get into that reflector, the node number is 9126. So if you can get to any repeater capable of connecting to an IRLP node, then you dial in 9126 and you become part of the EPOS repeater. I hope that answers.
Okay, I think it does. Let's see if Barry is happy with that answer. And Rich, I still think you could use a little bit more rodeo. Barry, you got it.
Thanks, Rich, for that. Okay, so it's 9126 is an IRLP node. I understand there's also an Echolink node, or there is no Echolink node, or possibly that New England repeater can be accessed by Echolink.
You want me to answer directly?
Go right ahead, Rich. And shout a little louder into your mic is my recommendation.
Okay, it's definitely me that's causing the problem there with the voice. I just don't have it tonight. You can try the, when you go to Echolink, try the N2STU Echolink node, and that's connected to 7.5 machine, which should also bring you right into the 8.5. So it's N2 Steve Thomas Union. That's pretty bad phonetics, but that should bring you right in there, back to that, into KNB.
And Barry, you got any further questions? And you should be better than me. Wait for the beep.
Okay, why are we getting the beep there? Yeah, okay, N2STU. Terrible call letters, but it comes out sounding like STU. I don't want to cut that one. Okay, thank you so much. I'm going to play with that. And that gets me into the New England repeater, which gets me to RLLP, which gets me into Limark. Oh, you say. Okay, thanks, Rick. N2ST. After I digest that one, I will have another question. Thanks, guys.
While we've got you, Barry, I'm kind of curious, what's the status of your 80-meter electronically steerable, vertically polarized antenna array thing? that you're putting up on your Windjammer tower. I keep calling it Windjammer. Aero Motor or something like that is a model number of it. And as you probably know, if you've listened to the last week, Mel, K2KEY, is trying desperately to talk me into putting up an 80-meter vertically polarized dipole on my tower. Right now I've got a piece of yellow polypropylene rope going to the top of the tower with a pulley at the top. It's tied to a tree. All I have to do is connect the dipole to it and haul it up. And by walking the bottom of the dipole at various distances from the base of the tower, I'd have a sloper, a full halfway vertically polarized sloper with some distance above the ground, and I could experiment with angles to find out what gives the strongest signal. And he's positive it's going to be a rock crusher if I do that. I'm not a great 80-meter enthusiast, but as soon as I get out from under a couple of my crazy projects right now that my clients have me doing, I'd like to start doing that. So wonder how your steerable array is working there, Barry. N2MB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, actually, kind of like yourself, I'm not the biggest enthusiast of 75 or 80 meters, whatever you call it. Really not. I play around with it mostly because my favorite toy, the satellite, isn't doing much of late. I suspect it will before the this year is over. They'll have something up there to play around with. But in the meantime, I'm spending my time fooling around with the bestest 75-meter thing I could come up with on my property. And so far, I still haven't put the other element up because the weather hasn't been good and I haven't been feeling all that well. But right now, I'm feeling much better. Happy to say I got out there and ran like 4 miles on the boardwalk this morning and yesterday. I'm getting myself back in shape to climb towers. And I have all the material here for putting the second element on. And I'm going to, electrically phase them. That's the plan. Two vertical dipoles. Well, actually, two inverted Vs or something. Vertical dipoles, basically. And they're connected together electrically so that I can phase them and switch them and all that kind of stuff. But while I was sitting there staring at the ceiling tonight, half in a dream and half awake, this crazy idea came to my mind. My buddy Richie gave me a Hustler antenna, which is basically a 75-meter antenna for a car. You know. And of course, we've all said, well, if you put two of those together, we could have a little dipole. It's not going to have much capture area. But I was playing around with that, and it worked quite well. So I'm thinking to myself, as a receiving antenna, I could put two of those on a boom, electrically phase them, and have a steerable two-element beam. And it probably would have good directivity, which is basically what I want, and a halfway decent front-to-back ratio. I don't give a darn about the gain. What do you think of that, Dick?
I think that would be approximately 10 decibels better than you anticipate. And here's why. The Hustler is some kind of a spirally wound, compacted, 80-meter whip-like thing with a loading coil maybe to it, intended for 75-meter mobile operation. It's a compacted antenna. And yes, it's a monopole, expecting to use the rest of the automobile as its counterpoise. And the rest of the automobile is way undersized as a counterpoise. Therefore, the other half of the antenna, so to speak, the counterpoise, is going to be highly capacitive. Therefore, the Hustler, when you put a pair of them back-to-back, I think at first, until you do something, it's going to be tuned a little bit low in frequency, is my guess. But that's an easy one to correct. However, you may have heard me talk from time to time about the so-called infinitesimal dipole. There's a very pivotal, innocent-looking paragraph in Krauss's original book called Antennas, McGraw-Hill, 1950, and you look at the chapter on infinitesimal antenna, and you'll see something that's a mind-blower. As you dig into that chapter and read what he is saying, and he's dead right, it's been confirmed many times, the bottom line is this. Start off with a full 80-meter dipole, 132 feet long, resonant on your favorite frequency, maybe at 3750 kilohertz. Start shrinking the dipole electronically, mechanically. You start making it shorter and shorter, and you either re-resonate it by putting loading coils in the right spot, top hat capacitors at the tips, an antenna tuner at the center, or a very low loss feed line, open wire line, an antenna tuner in the shack. You're tuning the antenna radiating system, but you're resonating it. As long as you keep the antenna resonant, as you make it mechanically smaller, and you bring it down to whatever you think is an infinitesimal dipole, like a couple of meters long on the 80-meter band. At first, that sounds crazy. Two things happen that are bad. Number one, the antenna becomes extremely narrow band, high in Q, and I'll explain why in a minute. Number two, as you QSY in frequency, because it's high in Q, you've got to retune it. Move 10 kc up the band, and you're going to want to retune the antenna to get it down below a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. So it's narrow band. However, its effective capture area, its gain, and its pattern is essentially unchanged. When you go from a full half-wave dipole, 130-some-odd feet long, down to a couple of feet or a couple of meters long, because the pattern becomes a little bit fatter, you lose exactly 4/10 of a dB of gain. That's it. And it's not real efficiency loss, and it is not effective capture area loss. 4/10 of a dB gain. A full half-wave dipole has 8,500 square feet of real radio area. You can measure it, you can confirm it. Although your eye can't see it, it's really there. You build an infinitesimal dipole, and I'm going to guess the 8,500 feet goes half a dB down, you're going to be around 8,000 square feet, something like that. And you're about to say, how can something a few feet long act like 8,500 square feet? And I'm going to tell you that's the magic of resonance. And I'm going to show you what that means. In the case of the full half-wave dipole, that signal you send down the dipole on each half cycle goes down to the end, bounces back. Very little of it gets radiated on the first bounce. That signal has to bounce back and forth something like 20 or 30 times, an exponential decaying curve for each individual wave that you're launching, and you're watching that particular wave compared to all the others that are bouncing around. And what you and I call resonance is really making sure that all of those bounces stay in step. You make the dipole mechanically a little bit too short and don't resonate it, re-resonate it electronically, and now your bounces, your 20 bounces before the signal finally gets radiated, get out of step. And they start leading in phase, and you and I say it's capacitive. Look at any of the good curves in Chapter 4 of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, and you sweep the signal in frequency, tweak the antenna in frequency, and you realize the reactive component changes very rapidly. The resistive component changes very slowly. That's the magic of resonance. You just have to keep all those bounces in step. Radiation is hard. You have to kick that signal in the tail 20 times in a row before it finally radiates. Make the antenna electrically small. Instead of it bouncing 20 times, it bounces 40 times. Make it smaller yet, it bounces 60 or 80 times before it gets finally radiated. Because you're bouncing a larger number of times, that's the reason why the antenna is more narrowband. As you start making it mechanically a little bit shorter or longer, or QSYing a little bit up or down, because you're asking for 60 or 80 bounces, they get out of step real fast if it's not exactly at resonance. That's why the Q, that's the definition of the Q being so high. So in the case of transmitting, you now see the mechanism by which it becomes narrowband. But as long as you've made the antenna out of low-loss materials, the fact that there's 40 bounces versus 20 bounces means that you're still radiating 95% of that energy into space. Very little of it's being turned into heat.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Once you accept that phenomena for real radiating on transmission, and it's really doing it with 90-some-odd% efficiency, and because you know, because we've been beating it into everybody's head, it's almost like a religion, every antenna with reasonable assurance meets the phenomena of reciprocity. Whatever gain, pattern, effective area, whatever it has, visual bandwidth, to anything you can measure about that antenna. When you measure it in the transmit mode, it must have the exact same performance in the receive mode. So it's got all of that area on transmitting, and that extra area on a short dipole is made up by a lot more bounces. By the same token, when you receive, that small antenna has all of that area unreceived. You're about to say, how can that tiny little antenna do it? Well, what's happening is that that signal, as it comes by, sets up this reflecting pattern, and it takes a whole lot of individual bounces for the signal to achieve the resonance, so to speak. You could say it sucks up a little bit of the signal on each bounce, but the small antenna, the signals are going to be bouncing 40 or 60 times, and it's sucking up a little bit on each one of those bounces, and it eventually comes up with almost the exact same effective capture area. Yes, I know it sounds like magic. It sounds like a fairy tale. It's too good to be true. You go ahead and measure the gain and effective capture area of your tiny antenna. As long as it's made out of lossless materials, and as long as you resonate it, it will have that area, it will have that gain. Ain't that nice? N2 Moon Bounce, K2LIW in the deck bed.
Okay, and while I'm sitting there daydreaming, the other thought was, if I have two elements, which is what I plan on starting with, maybe three on the gun, how close can I put them together? I still have an antenna that has decent front-to-back ratio. I'm not that concerned about the forward gain. But I am concerned about the boom length, obviously. But I have to turn that on top of my tower. So what is the practical distance on 75 meters to put those together? And then, of course, phase them electronically rather than to phase them, you know, the usual way by having interacting between one element and the other. I think that would be really rough.
Okay, you're now getting into the Yagi-like phenomenon, and you can make a Yagi-like antenna by feeding all the elements and make sure they've all got the right amplitude and phase angle. Or you can do it in a parasitic manner, like an ordinary Yagi, where you adjust the length and the position. In the case of a two-element 80-meter antenna that's highly compacted, you can start off with the reflector to driven element distance, which is, I'm not sure of the exact number, but maybe on a typical design, it's in the vicinity of an eighth wave to a quarter wave of spacing, something like that. And with the right adjustments of length, you can get a moderately good front-to-back ratio and a few dB of gain. As you move that reflector or director, whatever your first parasitic element is going to be, as you move it closer and closer, the antenna becomes more narrowband, the tuning becomes more critical, but you still can find a method of tuning it. As you make the elements very, very close, you do get overcoupling. Therefore, the amount of signal that's on the parasitic element is a little bit longer, a little bit higher than you want it to be. And the circulating currents between the driven element and the parasitic element start climbing higher pretty fast. So whatever loss you've got in those elements is going to start multiplying when you make the distance real short. So you may have to do some feeding in order to try to decouple. In other words, by feeding some signal intentionally into the parasitic element that's out of phase, you can do some decoupling because you've got super close spacing. One of the things that I was involved in was a super compacted Yagi at 900 megacycles, where the elements had to be closer than I wanted them to be, and I put a great big wide chunk of sheet metal in the vicinity of the boom in order to decrease the coupling coefficient between driven element and first director. And that got me some of the gain back and got me some of the bandwidth back, even though the spacing to the first director was too close. So there's various ways that you can control the coupling coefficient, which ordinarily would be too high when you make it small. So I think you could make it an eighth wave. And let's see, what would an eighth wave? If half wave is 130, quarter wave is going to be 60, eighth wave is going to be 30. I think you could make it a little less than 30 feet of spacing between the parasitic element and the driven element and get essentially full performance out of it, Barry. And if you're a little bit smarter, maybe even closer than that. N2MB, K2LIW.
K2KY.
Stand by, Barry. Go ahead, Mel.
Well, a couple of guys that have come on, you know, BB, and I know Barry, his thinking on 75 meters, that didn't sound like the sepate of 75 like I am. He's joined me once in a while, but I guess he got mad at me, so now he's taken away. But, all kidding aside, the few guys that had direct-to-barrage on 75 that I bumped over. So now there's not too many of them, but let's take him at 40. And he's got that big three-element monstrosity there in Hampshire, WW1WW. Is facing his point two wavelength. I asked him what's the space between them. And point two wavelength. Now the question arises, is it bigger or better? And I can tell you, I'll let you pick up with Barry first, and then I'll tell you about whether it's bigger or better, because I'll tell you about the guy with the, remember I told you about the five wavelength loop? Well, questioned him, and I'm going to tell you something that he said and proved. So, first let's continue. I don't want to get this off the track. Dick, go ahead.
Go ahead, Bill. You're on a roll. I'm listening, and I think what you've got to input here is good. So let's keep going.
Yeah. Mel, you got us on the edge of our seat. Keep going.
Hey, if you remember, I told you a week ago, this guy came on with a quad. He's got a rural area of Kentucky, works for the power light company there. So he's got a bucket truck, and he's got a lot of tall trees, and he's got a lot of wire, so he can handle paradise, basically. Well, he put up a loop for 75 meters, like I have and all, and he put one up, a separate one up for 160 and 180. Listening on his loop, he says, gee, looks pretty good, sounds pretty good, bands open, everything like that. And all of a sudden he noticed that he was on his 160-meter loop and not on his 75-meter loop. So he switched back and forth. And he says, what is this? He says, my 160 loop seems to be doing a lot better than my 75-meter loop. In other words, he's now at two-way plane on 75. So with that thinking, he goes ahead, and this is bothering him. He has the wire and everything. Well, he went ahead and he modified. He made his 75-meter loop now two-way plane, and he made his 160 another way plane. But now it's both two-way plane. And he says the experiment repeated, and again, now the 160 is now winds up at four-way plane on 175, and he shows. And for some reason, his signal is much better, Dick. He's now wound up. He's got, what do you call him right now? I think he's wound up with, he's got four wavelengths now on 75, Dick. It surely is a heck of a signal he puts out, over.
Yeah, you asked me this question, or at least a portion of that question, I guess it was, a week or so ago, and my prediction is that whenever you go more than a quarter wavelength on a side of a full wavelength loop, so to speak, or more than a half wavelength of antenna, you start developing other lobes. At the peaks of those lobes, you're going to get more and more gain as you get longer and longer, but you're going to develop some valleys in between. And if you guys are lucky enough to be in the right direction, that you're not in one of those valleys, he's always going to get more gain with more wire. But everything I know about long, multiple wavelength antennas tell me that very similar to what happens with a rhombic. Rhombic develops some very nice, strong lobes, but it does have some nulls in between those lobes. So there are going to be some directions in which you don't have great coverage, but where he's got two separate antennas, he can flip back and forth in two separate locations. Sounds to me like he can have a grand old time. Wire is not that expensive. He's got the property. If I was him, I would go for it. Barry's got a whole lot of property here in Brooklyn, so he's about to, he was at one time going to build a beverage antenna quite a few wavelengths long, but that's another story. N2MB, K2LAW in the TechNet.
What I think you guys are telling me is that this fellow's loop antennas are full-size loops. They're not compacted in any way. Is that correct?
Without a doubt, that's what Mel's been telling you. He started off with a full wave on both 80 and 160, two separate antennas, and now he's made them into multiple waves, and he appears to be getting stronger and stronger signals. He's going way beyond full size just to see what happens. And by the way, I have speculated, you can read about this in the article at WA1MDA.org, Mr. Williams' website, where at the bottom of it I've got this article about getting perfect impedance match to the driven element of a Yagi. I had speculated what would happen if you made the driven element of a Yagi a full wave long versus a half wave long. Very similar set of circumstances. Back to you, Barry.
Okay. Now, of course, Mel has a large loop on his property, and he's got a small one, I guess, in the shack. And he's told me many times, because he can change direction and angle, that he does much better with the loop in the shack. I've always said that works. I like that idea, but I wanted to give this thing some front-to-back ratio to enhance it. That's probably why I'm thinking it. So I guess to make it something that I could rotate and put 100 feet off the ground easily, probably something like a 30-foot boom and four of these Hustler antennas, you know, to make like a two-element beam out of it and save them electronically rather than parasitically so that I could get them close together. And I think that's going to be my project for the summer. I've been, you know, I was thinking of this, and I have an arrangement. The first thing I'm trying to do now, as you all know, is my two vertical dipoles, which are full size, and I'm going to turn those into a steerable thing. But of course, it's not so steerable. So I'm anxious to compare that to my thing that I'm going to put on the tower. Now, the advantage of putting this thing on the tower with these little tiny antennas is that I can go from horizontal to vertical, and I could turn it any which way I want. So that's a lot, especially when you're trying to receive stations. That's quite a bit.
And you can go one step way beyond that, Barry. You're right at the threshold, whether you know it or not. That's called polarimetry. Mel's loop in the shack, which is tiny wavelength-wise, but resonating, that's the clue, that's where all the magic comes from. That's why you and I could build a loop antenna that's 160 kilohertz band, and as long as we resonate it with low-loss materials, we're going to get essentially full performance inside. The advantage of Mel's loop in the shack is you can tune it in azimuth, elevation, and polarization, because that ionosphere with its Faraday rotation is rotating that polarization a number of times before it gets from his shack to the guy in Philadelphia, or from his shack to his buddy in London, so to speak. So where you're going to have a vertically polarized, electronically steerable antenna, and a horizontally polarized, mechanically steerable antenna, by you selecting the right amplitude ratio between the two, you will be able to choose polarization and the right phase shift between the two. You can rotate the polarization, make it elliptically polarized, making it slant right, slant left, clockwise, counterclockwise. And so you can electronically, with mechanical help there, of the Hustler rotation. And by the way, the Hustlers, if you feed them electronically to get forward front to back, you can electronically flip from forward to backward in milliseconds instead of waiting for 30 seconds for the rotation of the whole array. Very nice at times. But what I'm getting at is now, by feeding both sets of antennas with the right combination of signals in amplitude and phase, you can have a grand old time turning the controls on your great big control panel in the shack, maximizing that signal in the receive mode, and then with slight different setting of the controls, maximizing the signal getting to your buddy on the other side of the world in the transmit mode. N2MB, K2LIW.
One more thing, KTY.
Go ahead, Mel.
The guy came out with one of them, two loops on a boom, supported by a boom, two loops, puts it outside. He claims you should see these things. I think he calls them a TAM antenna or KAM antennas. But there's a guy producing that exact, the antenna that you're talking about. The Hustler antennas, like Barry was just talking about, there's one on the market like that. That is the same configuration. The Hustler antenna is just, you know, two pipes that go on the mobile. It's a pipe that goes on a mobile, actually. I was going to say two pipes, but it's a pipe.
and on top of it, the top loader, there's a coil. It's not a spiral. It's a coil. It's the chain band. You got to screw it. You fold the antenna roll, but it's got a hinge. And you screw another coil on. Now, the guy came out and doesn't want to market it like that, with that, but I tried that, and it worked, but it's not quite as good as that antenna. We tried it at the park last year, and they bring all kinds of antennas now. We tried it, and it worked out great. They compared to, compared it just to a vertical I had. But this guy came up with one of those two vertical loops on a boom, made for outside. He ruggedized it and everything. There goes.
Phil?
Go ahead, Barry.
I spoke to that fellow, like DKU or something like that, in New Jersey. And I want to one up him. What he has is not a beam. He's not looking at a slow beam. He's looking at a very compact, kind of a dipole thing, you know. And he's got two elements, but it's basically two halves of a dipole. And it's all, you know, rolled up and it's compact. And it works very well. It's a very, very compact 75-meter antenna. Kind of like a duck. And I think it works well. It's actually good for mobile because it's not a big box. I believe he has one he sells in the 275, there's another one for 40. He started making them for 40, I think. I think when he gets to 20 meters, it doesn't make any sense because he might as well go to a new beam. But I want to one up the guy, and I want to have actually directively, like a beam, you know. So we do depart from each other a little bit now, don't we?
Okay, I didn't know whether or not that is directive or not. I didn't look that closely. He does say something about rotating it. What's the reason for rotating it then, over?
I'm on the telephone. I'll be right back.
Okay, very good, Barry. Yeah, I know it's the guy in Jersey. Now, he puts it on a pole and he's rotating it. Now, what the heck would he be rotating if it has no front or back or any type of ball gain or whatever? I have no idea what he's got. But I was wondering, Dick, that the receiving loops that I have in the shack are very, boy, you can really, in other words, peak them. I mean, you can see, moving that variable capacitor in or out a little bit makes a heck of a difference, and moving that those loops a few degrees either way or tilting has a tremendous effect on them. Now, if you went ahead and made up some kind of a boom using this type of method and had some way of adjusting it, do you think you can have some kind of effective directional or front to back on an array of this sort over time?
I'm going to have to sign out of here for a few minutes, but I just wanted to say this before just before it gets turned on. One second. Yeah. Dick, the advantage of having these things, these little, you know, hustler things on the boom is I can go from horizontal to vertical just by rotating the boom. So that's kind of a real advantage because it's a small antenna, and you can do that very easily just by putting a rotator on the boom. And I think that's a cool idea. And I will be back in about 15 or 20 minutes. I'm sorry I got to do that. Over to you, Dick, N2MD.
Sounds like a fun antenna. Mel, when you were comparing Hustler to some other antenna, were you comparing it to another 80-meter mobile antenna of some kind? Or was it a back-to-back Hustler that was how it was going polarized? I think you told us you were a little bit disappointed with the Hustler performance on one of your shootouts. So tell me, what was the competitive antenna in that shootout? K2KEY, K2LIW.
I'll tell you, this is K2KEY. I'm using the Hustler as strictly as a regular mobile whip, conventional mobile whip. But there have been experiments. Guys have tried to take them, put them back, do all kinds of things. They had other coils on, top hats and all, and they haven't proved really that they've been able to make any substantial improvement on it. In some cases, just quick windmills to ride along the parkway, especially with. Now, this antenna that Barry was just talking about, it looks like quite an unusual looking thing.
and I doubt if you can run in Mobile. I think it would be too much wind. But as far as my Hustler being on the Mobile by itself, well, you know, comparing it from Mobile to Mobile, it's the best of the Mobile antennas so far that we've tried out. What Barry wants to do now is try to turn them into a horizontal type of, small type of a beam, and then maybe turn it to be able to put on the boom a rotator and try rotating it vertically and things like that. I don't know. But my question is, if you took my receiving and you added another one behind it, mounted it some way together in some way, I don't know how to come up with some configuration, do you think you could actually, by adjusting the variables or whatever, do you think you could actually find maybe a more of a direct antenna fix with something that's less than 0.1 wavelength in circumference?
Absolutely. Your 0.1 wavelength in circumference antenna doesn't matter what its physical size is, Mel. As long as you resonate it, it has the area you desire, as long as you made it out of low-loss materials. So it electronically, at least at the frequency you tuned it to, is essentially a full half-wave dipole. I know that's hard to believe. You get on 80 meters or 20 meters any day and you tell them that a compact antenna that's resonant has the same effective area, and 98% of those people are going to jump down your throat and say you're crazy, we ain't going to talk to you anymore. I mean, what I'm saying, of course, sounds weird, but once you dig into what's really going on, real antenna theory, which is a lot stranger than fiction, where the effective area of an antenna comes from, it's not something your eye can see. So a guy who puts a pair of Hustlers back to back can easily fall into a trap. He doesn't realize that each Hustler, whether there's one or two of them there, doesn't matter, when they resonate, they're trying to get close to 8,000 square feet of area. If it was a full half-wave dipole, that 8,000 square feet of area would be a great big elliptical surface around that full half-wave 132-foot dipole. That elliptical surface, the effective capture area, would be probably something like 140 feet wide by something like 50 feet high. That's the long dimension and the short dimension of the ellipse. Therefore, you can easily fall into a trap, because when you build a dipole on, let me say, 6 meters, and you're trying to test it anything more than 10 or 15 feet above the ground, as far as ground effect is concerned, you're able to get pretty much the antenna pattern effective capture area. Most of the effective capture area is not including the ground when you mount a 6-meter dipole, we'll say 15 feet above the ground. Mount a 80-meter Hustler dipole 15 feet above the ground of that great big elliptical area it's trying to create, 50 feet high and 140 feet wide. A big chunk of that is inside of the Earth. You ain't going to get anywhere near the performance you think you should be getting. You don't have it at the right altitude. You haven't realized what effective capture area it's trying to create. Now, once you take this compacted loop antenna of yours and mount a pair of them on a boom the right number of wavelengths apart and feed them correctly, there's nothing stopping you from getting essentially whatever front-to-back ratio you want. And once you get that front-to-back ratio, you're going to get more than 3 decibels of forward gain over that which you would get out of one single antenna. And if you're smart enough to make that boom so it can be rotated around the axis of the boom, you now can rotate it in polarization. The only thing you can't do easily is tilt it. But you could put a tilting mechanism on it. Therefore, you could make a Yagi out of a pair of loop antennas mounted at the right altitude on top of your tower. You're going to have a very narrow band, but very compact, highly directive antenna that you can steer in azimuth, elevation, and polarization. Now you're going to get all the performance that you get in the shack with the additional performance of the extra altitude, meaning you clear the local terrain, and some of what you previously had as blockage, even that will disappear. You could make a humdinger of an antenna that has an extremely small wind load. It'll have very narrow bandwidth, but boy, because of its compact size and light weight and pounds, you're going to have all kinds of adaptability in azimuth, elevation, and polarization, and I think that's going to be a rock crusher of an antenna. It uses concepts that are opposite of common sense. That's why you'll be blazing a brand new trail. That's why no one has ever gone there before. That's a whole bunch of strongly felt opinions. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay. The problem is, of course, how the heck are you going to tune it? It's critical. I can say that the variable condensers, both of them that are on both my the receiving loop that I use direct that I direct and the other one that I use, that goes into it, the other one that I use for the noise condenser into the QRS washer. They're both very critical, the adjustment. You move any appreciable, even in the shack, if you move it a little bit, you got to repeat it, you got to retouch it. So it would be a problem up there. You'd have to figure some way out with motors and things to be able to improve the thing, because you can't, like I say, you can't budge too much off the frequency without retouching it. So it would be a bit of a problem, I guess. Yes, you could experiment and come up with something, but not a simple thing to, like they said, divide Dick over.
Don't give up so easily, Mel. There are stepper motors that have very fine resolution. There are stepper motors with gears that will give you even finer resolution. Where that capacitor is so touchy, and I understand that, we know the antenna is very small in wavelength, therefore it's going to be very narrow band, meaning very high in Q. Therefore, very critical in tuning. Both your Q multiplier or noise squasher coil versus your real main tuning coil. But with the right kind of a stepper motor, you can get there. And you can have a coarse-tuned capacitor and a fine-tuned capacitor. A small variable in parallel with the great big variable. You get into the ballpark with the big variable and then flip over to the small variable. All of these are remote servo motors, stepper motors, and whatever. I know it is doable. You have the technology. K2KEY, go for it. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
There's a place called Surplus Sales of Nebraska. It's a website where they basically sell a lot of old surplus antenna tuners that'll tune basically a 6-foot piece of wire from about, around 1.4 to 30 megahertz auto-tune. And if you wanted to put this all the way out of the load, it'll handle full legal limit power and then some. Then they come in all different shapes of kits, and where you can buy the individual parts from them, KC2QIQ.
Roughly how expensive is that setup from your impression, Glenn?
I think they're roughly about $1 a watt. So in other words, like a 500-watt system, full CW load is about $500. The kilowatt version of it is about $1,000. And I've seen them go as high as about, depending on how many additional things you want to add to it, like they have a 10-kilowatt version, it probably runs like around $3,500.
Yeah, Mel has the resources to do that. But the Mel I know has also got some pride. He likes doing things himself. He's going to make a Chinese copy of that, with stepper motors and fine-tuning and coarse-tuning and remote Delsons and whatever. He's going to do it homebrew. You wait and see. Go ahead, Mel.
Yeah, it's a great experiment. The time, the energy, and everything to get the parts, no doubt. Once I whet my appetite in for an experiment, I can really go for it. Back to our friend in Kentucky. He made a check. My God, he checked with everybody. Usually we've had as many as 10, 12 people on that frequency at night. And they're all over the place. Oh, the first one is up there in Oregon. We've got people down, and people come in from Texas and up north and everything, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Massachusetts, you name it. And everybody confirms. When he goes to the multi-wavelength loop, well, when he goes from, like, the one wavelength, one 75-meter loop, when he switched in, he uses his two wavelengths on 160, which becomes four wavelengths on 75. Oh, it's definitely a difference in his six. There's no doubt about it. It seems like I thought at first that he's, you know, pulling our legs, maybe sticking his amplifier, putting an amplifier on. But there's no doubt that it's all, like he said, just switching antennas. There's something going on that the multi-wave loop is doing so much more. And he's telling us about all the stations that call him in from all over places that others don't hear, and they're accusing him sometimes of making up stories that he's working this and that on 75 meters, which they don't believe, but he says he's swearing to it. So, are we coming up with something like, in a loop? The bigger the better, Dick, over.
Well, once you can take a antenna signal, a signal that's gotten through the ionosphere, and it's been scrambled in polarization, it's been disturbed in the pattern on the ground, in other words, there's multipath going on between the sky wave, the ground wave, and in many cases there's more than one sky wave, and they're beating against each other. So you have a certain pattern on the ground because of the multiple bounces of the sky wave, and you've got a certain polarization characteristic on the ground because of the Faraday rotation differences of each of the sky waves. Bear in mind that in certain places, you're getting two signals bouncing off that ionosphere coming to you, one by a short bounce and one by a long bounce. Each one is tilted a different amount in polarization. Therefore, at your particular location at one particular time, you may not be aware of it, but that signal may be thoroughly circular polarized. Very possible circular polarized, even though the guy who launched it was launching a pure linear wave. I guarantee that 98% of the time, the signal is elliptically polarized when it gets to your shack or it gets to your backyard. So anything you can do with polarization, polarimetry tuning could help. Anything you can do with pattern tuning will help. The Yagi-like phenomena you and I talked about, that gives you more gain, directive gain. You can decide where to aim it, as L and polarization. With those multiple wavelengths on the side, let me drop of that loop antenna of your buddy on the West Coast, he's getting more gain in some directions. I'm having trouble believing he's getting all of that gain in all directions at once. I'm having trouble believing that antenna is really a omnidirectional high gain thing like a station master. Station master gives all of its gain because it's essentially a pancake pattern. It is multiple wavelengths of collinear antenna vertically stacked, which means the vertical beamwidth is very narrow, but the horizontal beamwidth is 360 degrees. So if you could see it in three-dimensional space, it's a pancake. And as he squeezes that pancake more and more narrow vertically, the signal squirts out more and more to the horizon. As Ed often has said, WB2EAV, that is, it's a beanbag pattern. You push the beanbag in one direction, it squirts out somewhere else. Or you could call it a jello pattern. But still, that's the way antennas work. You don't get something for nothing when it comes to the gain of an antenna. Any gain you get in one direction, you are taking that signal away from some other direction. And that pancake pattern does that. So, omnidirectionally, you can get a lot of gain with a pancake pattern. I'm having trouble believing that a five wavelength on a side loop antenna is making a pancake pattern. I think it's making multiple fingers in space. But that's a relatively easy thing to model with some of the modern-day model computer modeling programs. I know antennas that are very difficult to model, even with the most modern programs. I'm working on some of those. In fact, some of my antenna patents are because the particular antenna hadn't been discovered before because the computer modeling programs couldn't handle that case of very wide elements. The finite element analysis would have too many little triangles, and it's too great big a matrix to be able to invert, and the computer says, tilt, I can't handle all that. But with me building a UHF version of it on my little antenna range on my desk at the salt mine, I can model 15 of those antennas in a day, and I can find combinations that have never been found before. It's working like a charm. So in the case of loop antennas, which are not super wide, as far as the conductor itself is concerned, It's just the multiple wavelengths of wire. This is very modelable. I'd love to see somebody take a one wavelength loop 40 feet above the ground, make it four wavelengths on the side, but still keep it 40 feet above the ground, and find out what the new antenna pattern is. That can easily be modeled. It's time you and I talk somebody into doing it now. K2KEY, K2RIW in the deck net.
K2RIW is coming. It bothers me that this is K2KEY. You know, I would agree. The only thing is that he asks a lot of people on frequency. In other words, if it was just talking to me, I'd say, okay, maybe I could say, beanbag is just pressed the right way for me. But here he's talking simultaneously. He's in Kentucky. Simultaneously talking to a guy that's on frequency in Oregon. These are the guys that join us Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. We have a nice group. One guy's in Oregon. We've got two guys down in Florida. We've got one guy up in Massachusetts. Two guys in Pennsylvania near Pittsburgh. Got another guy in, let's see, down in North Carolina. Larry down there in Ishmael. And all. I'm just thinking about all the different directions. A guy in Chicago is regular. Every one of them confirms that there was a heck of a difference. I mean, it's obvious that there was a heck of a, not just a subtle difference, but a heck of a difference when he switched from one wave to four waves. Like, that not one, I could say, said that, oh, no, no change, or the signal degraded. That's what is bothering me. I would agree right away, but that's what I couldn't comprehend. Go ahead.
That is a tough one. Go ahead, Glenn. I think it was Glenn that wanted to make a comment. Who was that person that wanted to add to this?
And KC2RGW, Chris, with a comment on the full wave loops.
Go right ahead, Chris, and let us know where you are. I don't know if we've talked to you before. My name is Dick, and I'm here on Long Island.
Good evening, KC. I've checked in a couple of times, just sporadically. I'm over in Middletown, New Jersey. Yes, Sevik or Kivik, W4RNL, I'm not sure how he pronounces his last name. He has some great models of horizontal polarized loops, and what you see, I'm looking right at his site, the EZNEC models that he did. You get the four wavelengths, so you have an 80-meter loop, and the model on 14 megahertz for 20 meters is what I'm looking at. You wind up with four sharp, distinct lobes. You wind up with 11.28 dBi, the way he calculated it. So you do get some considerable gain. So the nulls between those loops are fairly deep. So it looks like about four wavelengths is your point of diminishing returns, as it were. If you take a look at the models, pretty interesting data.
Very fine, Chris. Chris, do you happen to know a web address where we can see the results of that modeling? This is Seebeck. I can't remember the two letters of abbreviation in front of his name. I think he's a man that lives in the Georgia area, and he's got lots and lots of articles about computer modeling with the MiniNeck and similar programs. So is there a website that will allow Mel and I to see the pattern that you're looking at? Back to you, Chris.
I actually sent it to you. I emailed it to you about 10 minutes or so before I got on here. His main website is www.cebic.com. It's Charlie Echo Bravo India Kilo, CEBIK.com. And the extension is / it's FDIM Fox Delta India Mike / and ATL1 Alpha Tango Lima 1.html is the exact page. I actually emailed it to you. If you look up horizontally polarized loop, CEBIK in Google, it should bring you to that exact page, and I mailed it to whatever the email is you have on QRZ.
Well done. Well done. Mel, did you get a good copy on that, K2KEY?
Yeah, Roger. I think I've seen that, Dick. One of the guys I think recommended. I took a look at that a couple time ago. Very interesting to see what he modeled as the results. And yet, there's definitely something that takes place that doesn't fit the regular theory of how you would visualize going as you're going to multiple wavelengths. You have multiple, definitely multiple something going on there. And but they seem to be these multiple loads that simultaneously generate seem to be enhancing the signal, definitely. There is definitely an improvement. And I, there may be some angle somewhere that maybe it wouldn't be working, you know, better, that maybe it would be, maybe you'd get a lesser report. But so far, we haven't been able to find that, over.
Shape and feed point matters.
Yeah, also, I think I've got an explanation for what's going on now. It's going to tend to both interferometry and polarimetry. But we ought to go down our list first and cover the people who signed in, and then we're going to come back to this. I think I've got a partial explanation. I'm reasonably sure that what the CBEC curves are reporting are a reality. You're saying that, hey, when your buddy does that experiment, it doesn't seem to confirm. And it's one of these situations where if it doesn't fit, we must acquit. No, not necessarily. Don't give up yet. I think there's a little more complicated explanation going on, and I think we can possibly address that. Let's pick up Fred, because he signed in with a question. Kilo Charlie 2, Oboe Echo Sierra. Fred, if we haven't put you to sleep, go right ahead with your question. K2LIW on the TechNet.
That's negative, Dick. I heard you say yes, but I was just letting it go until you got to me. But I have no questions at this time. Thank you.
Okay. I know that Joe probably had a question. The A2RYY. Go right ahead, Joe.